But basically, by putting every small detail on my LinkedIn profile, I suddenly was getting like 5 to 10 inbound recruiting messages per day.
You are listening to Ambition Out Loud, the podcast for ambitious women tired of being underestimated and undervalued at work. Together, we're tackling workplace sexism, our own insecurities and self-doubt, and getting practical advice to move our careers forward. I'm your host, Nicole Magoo, and I'm an ambitious woman.
Swing. You should have seen that final show. I'm gonna go down swinging, and long after I am gone, when you hear that melody, you'll still remember me. That's how this girl is gonna carry on.
Hello, everyone. My name is Nicole, as you know, and today I am speaking with a former colleague, an amazing CrossFit goddess, and one of my favorite people in the world to work with. Her name is Carly Shields, and actually, I love her so much that she has done some consulting work for me since we parted ways officially. So, Carly, why don't you take a minute and just introduce yourself to everyone?
Okay. Yeah. Hello. As Nicole said, my name is Carly. I work in digital marketing, which could mean anything between creatively coming up with campaigns and messaging all the way through to putting it together in automation patterns so that it gets delivered to the right person at the right time based off of what they do, all the way back through to reporting and analytics on the success of the campaign. So it's a multifaceted role, and I've been doing that since 2014 or so. So I guess it's kind of been a bit. So the time has really gone by. But anyway, when I used to work with Nicole, I was in a hybrid role helping her with customer success and also working on marketing and marketing automation. So everything is sort of ties together, and that's how we met, and now we're here.
Oh. Awesome. She is quite the little spitfire, and I don't say that to sound derogatorily. She is petite, which is, you know, part of the package that you get with Carly, but she is little but fierce, and I think that probably feeds into some of your CrossFit passion. What do you think?
Yeah, they say if you're into CrossFit, you have a couple screws loose, and we have a joke in my gym about it being my kind of crazy or my kind of psycho. And I have a coach who will often tell me, Shields, don't be psycho. So, because you want to try things, I don't know, you want to try things over and over again to try and do better, even though there are an infinite number of circumstances that could be influencing you on any given day that you may be aware of, may not be aware of, but it's all about figuring out what's inside your control and focusing on that. So if you're not making a personal record that day and you don't know why, you should just stop trying, which sounds negative, but it's just sort of like an acceptance of what is that day. And then you can move on and trust the process, they say. So yes, it is a little bit of psycho, but it does take some real perseverance. So
it sounds to me like it's just a growth-driven culture where you guys are always trying to push yourselves to be a little bit better every day.
It absolutely is. And a lot of people are competitive outwardly and they will try and beat their friends. But I've always been inwardly competitive. I just like to be better than I was yesterday and basically just feel cool while doing it. So that's kind of it, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I also bring up the Spitfire reference because you are incredibly resourceful as far as people go. You're a very versatile, kind of like know what you want and go after it person. And so that brings us to why I asked you on the podcast today. And guys, this conversation is going to be a little bit more casual and less formal just because Carly and I know each other so well. We're just going to kind of roll with it today. Carly is a master at landing herself in multi-competitive offer situations. And she's been doing this for a while now. So I do think this is definitely a unique skill set. There's not a lot of people I know that have gotten themselves into multi-offer situations like that. And Carly's done it more than once. So Carly, why don't you kind of just take us back to the earlier days. What did you go to college for? What was your early professional experience like? And what led up to that very first situation where you found yourself with multiple job offers coming in at the same time?
Yeah, would love to talk about that. There's a lot. I mean, I will go back and I will start with the whole story. And it's not short, so you just have to bear with me. I'm also a long-winded person, but I think it comes with the nature of someone who is in a line of work about communicating with others. So that's where I'm at. But yeah.
We want it all, so yes. Don't hold back.
So I originally went to school with a major in fine art because I thought I was going to be a professional photographer. And I love photography, both darkroom and digital. It's an influence I had growing up from my dad, who I'm really close with, and also my grandfather, who passed when I was two, but also had a darkroom in their house. And when I was in high school and really getting into this, we dug out all of his stuff, his darkroom stuff that was in our crawl space that had been there since 1992, and built a darkroom in a spare. I mean, when we had finished our basement, we had planned on having a bathroom and then never built the bathroom. So we kind of had the perfect storm for putting together an ad hoc darkroom. We had the space that was not being used for anything. And then that was a dark, small box. And then we also had all of the darkroom stuff. So that was really cool and really tapped into my creative side. And then of course, when you go to college, it's all about, I mean, they had a darkroom, but it's really all about digital. And being 2009, when I started college, that was where I was at. And there was really no darkroom, but knowing the fundamentals of darkroom chemistry really help in your artistic eye and figuring out what you're going to do on screen in something like Photoshop. And using the camera as a mechanical tool and understanding the physics of it and the light and how things move through it. So that really spoke to me and I was really good at that. And I had the artistic eye. But the fall of my junior year, I heard about this new program from a professor out in the business school who I never went into the business school. I was always in the art building. And he wanted to get students out to San Francisco to work on, to learn about tech and startups and digital innovation and spend a semester technically abroad and then basically be in internships at startups and then tour all these different companies. So I did that. And it was a life-changing experience semester for me because I realized that what I liked about photography was that marriage of creativity and tech. And when I mentioned being able to understand the physics and the mechanics of the camera as a tool and not just something where you push a button and you get a photo out, we take for granted everything that happens just having cameras on our phone these days. So combined with the creativity was something that I was really good at. And it in 7 or 8 years later, translating that to digital marketing, it's a no-brainer because it's this hybrid role anyway of someone who has to be able to understand the mechanics and the analytics based, and then also have creativity for being able to put something together that resonates with your audience. So a little bit fast forward there, but basically that semester in San Francisco, I landed an internship at a later stage company that was on the cusp of social media marketing. Facebook had just moved to Timeline, and all of the statistics around the industry were people will buy things like 14% more likely from a recommendation from a friend than from an ad. And of course, they're using the term friend, like Facebook friend in this case, which at the time had more leeway because the algorithms were different. We friended everyone that we could find. And you had networks of like 1,000 friends that maybe you went to high school with that were suddenly talking about all these different things you couldn't discover prior. So social media marketing was a big deal. And I really liked that because, again, it was something that was creative that also dealt with trying to sell things and based on algorithms and what people liked and what people did. and what Facebook would recommend to you based off of the other things that you talked about and liked. So it was all this impact on what am I doing that makes me a good candidate for this ad or makes me a good candidate for this other post that my friend said about X product that I talked about 2 weeks ago, et cetera. So that got me a lot of connections in San Francisco. And then when I graduated, where I went back to school and I changed my major, I dropped all of my art classes the beginning of my senior year. And I picked up classes in what was called interactive media studies, which was the field of study that this fell under. So that summer between my junior and senior year, the state of Ohio, I went to Miami of Ohio. They had just approved the IMS major as a standalone major. And so I ended up dropping all my classes, like I mentioned, and then overloading both semesters to be the first graduate of the IMS major. And then my photo turned to a minor. And then I also had another, what is also technically another minor in what we called practical business theory and social media marketing because of my internship. So when I graduated, I moved out to San Francisco and I ended up working for a startup that was trying to be a database of all the other startups. So not only was I working in an early stage company that originated out of the penthouse apartment in a high rise in San Francisco overlooking the bay, but also we were talking about all the other companies and all the other metrics that we were going to track so that we could give good growth signals. And it was supposed to be a tool for venture capitalists to be able to find the next big investment before anyone else did because they had access to our data in our database and they would be able to say like, oh, this company must have just raised a bunch of money because their employee count has gone up on LinkedIn and things like that. So that directly impacted my desire and need to want to work for another startup and another early stage company because there was so much that you could do and so much impact you could have. And at this point in my career, I hadn't had any experience at a big corporate gig or anything where I had process bottlenecks or political problems. We were 15 employees. Our founders would order us food and drinks like every Friday after work. And we would all just party together on Friday nights and then come back to work on Monday like nothing had happened. We were that tight knit of a group. And the founder had also founded, or she had been the first employee at another company, which is a big name. But if I say it, I'll give away her identity. So anyway, she had a big impact on me because she just networked and she just blogged all the time. And she was just doing all these things that got people to follow her. And she established herself as a thought leader and she had all this credibility online based off of what, from what I could see, was just her opinions. I don't think she cited a lot of sources. She just made a lot of graphs and talked about a lot of cool stuff. And people liked it and then therefore started to trust her and she had a big following. And I didn't really understand at the time why that mattered later, but the networking thing was certainly something that I adopted when I had to then find my next job in Chicago because I was relocating from San Francisco to Chicago and I had a month left on my rent. And I said, okay, I'm going to find all the jobs I can while I'm still in San Francisco. And then when I get home, hopefully I just go on the final round interview, home. I grew up in the Midwest, so the Midwest was home. And then I would basically go from there. And so that's what I did. And that's sort of where that's the background. That's sort of where everything starts to pick up. I used a tool called AngelList because I was specifically targeting other startups. And I was still I had been in the working world for a year, so I didn't really have a lot of skills per se. I could show what I had done and achieved, but it didn't really have a lot of context or meaning behind it yet because I couldn't quite articulate where I wanted to go yet. I just knew that I had done this. I had a title of demand generation marketer. I knew how to send cold emails and set up meetings with my sales reps based off of the responses I got. And I didn't really have a hand in the messaging. I didn't really have a hand in testing out what was said, but I was able to like give a couple bullet points that I could sell myself. And just by showing a little bit of passion and having some industry lingo, I was able to get in with some of these founders on AngelList because it was such a small community and they knew that I was a little bit unusual having experience in San Francisco and Silicon Valley and then coming back to the Midwest. So that's sort of how that all started. And from that experience and just emulating what this other CEO had done, where I had worked in San Francisco, of just talking about things that were basically my opinion, but using the correct industry lingo and the right jargon and picking up the subtle communication cues on what people liked to hear and the buzzwords and all those things made me sellable. So I basically branded myself as this worker bee interested in startups. And by branding myself that way, I was able to get into the right kinds of companies where I was suddenly hireable. And from that scenario, I had 3 offers that came out of that. And by the time I flew back to Chicago after that month of job searching on AngelList, I had an in-person interview lined up for every day of the week plus some. So I think I had 7. And after 4 days of it, I had 3 offers and didn't go on the other ones. So, and that was purely just because I knew what to say. Yeah.
Okay, let's break this down just a little bit. Mm-hmm. All right, so you got into a spot where you had a mentor. Was she someone you worked directly with, or is she just someone you kind of watched from a distance?
We worked directly together, yeah. Because okay. She was this founding CEO, but we were so small that I reported directly to her.
So you got kind of this, one, you were able to observe what she was doing, but two, you had the ability to kind of pick it apart and determine the patterns that were leading to the successful outcomes she was achieving, it sounds like.
Yes. And this is, I mean, I have since iterated on this process, but this was the very early stages of figuring out how to get people to respond to you. Because in this case, I was doing all outbound job search, which was emulating the experience I had working for her by sending cold emails and trying to say the right thing and getting people to respond and then booking meetings. I mean, that's exactly what I had done in my job. And so that's basically, I didn't realize I was doing this at the time, but I was basically taking cues from her because she had been in the industry longer and kind of copying what she would say and how she would go about reaching out to people online and then getting them to meet me. And then once I had the interview, it was really easy because all it took was a little, this is what I can bring to the table. This is what I want to learn. This is what you need. And then meshing that all together and just being happy in an interview goes a long way. So, I mean, I was basically copying what this mentor had done. And in the very early stages, it worked for me because I mean, just the nature of the small community on AngelList and then knowing what to say.
So it sounds like you approached your very first job search. Well, I guess this wouldn't technically be your first. You got the job out of college that mm-hmm. took you to San Francisco, but mm-hmm. it sounds like you approached your job search moving back to Chicago as if you were in sales. It doesn't sound like you kind of followed the typical go find job descriptions, see which ones I might apply to, or I might be a like 70% fit for. It sounds like you instead, you got your list of leads and you just started cold calling them.
Yeah. I mean, you can message people on AngelList. And so that's what I did. And you only get like 300 characters. So it didn't even take me a long time. I just had this spiel that I typed out once I got the wording right and the character limit. And it was not even like a lot of industry knowledge. It was just like, I really like what you're doing. I want to be a part of it, which is a flattery play. And then this is what I've done. I'm profoundly interested in startups and technology. I want to help you build this. I see you have this position. I can do this. Can we talk? And then depending on how, I don't know how desperate the founder was. I don't know. Whoever had listed the job would get back to me. And I had a bunch of those responses. So yeah, this one was very salesy. But it taught me a lesson on making sure that you had the right words. It didn't really matter that I had the passion and the drive and that I was persistent about it, because getting in the door was all about knowing what I was talking about. So when they say you have job descriptions, and there's a statistic that men will apply to any job that they think is like maybe okay for them, but women will be like, oh, I'm not really qualified for this. Like, all of that just kind of doesn't matter. Like, if you know what you're talking about based off of what's in the job description, it was the right fit. And then that stemmed into a conversation. And then after that, once I had the interview and the conversation started, it all just kind of, the momentum took itself.
So that's interesting. I feel like what you hear frequently is that if I can get in a room with someone or if I can get on a phone with someone, then I can sell myself easily. But you seem to have had a really great success rate at getting that initial like response to the message you sent.
Yeah, in this case and in that scenario, selling myself was about proving that I knew what I was talking about. And I didn't necessarily know what I was talking about. I just picked up the buzz phrases and the buzzwords that I had heard this other woman say. And for that, I could get in the door.
So how would you extrapolate that if you were in a situation where you didn't have this awesome, you know, woman that you could kind of observe and absorb some of those buzzwords from? How would you go about that if you were in an industry that you weren't sure what the buzzwords were?
I don't think I would have gotten anywhere, because that's exactly the scenario I was in right after I graduated from college. I went on tons and tons of interviews as a new grad, and I didn't have a job until November after graduating in May, and all my friends had already been hired, and it was extremely painful to go through. I felt jaded. I was deflated. I was defeated. I didn't know what I was talking about. I would go on these interviews and they'd be like, what are you looking for? Which is a typical question you ask of a new grad because they don't know anything. And I didn't know what to say. I was like, you know, I want to be part of a big, like I was trying to describe my internship that I had in San Francisco. And I'm like, you know, I want to be able to be part of a team that works well together. I have good ideas. I work really hard. Like I didn't have the industry lingo and the jargon. And then the year I spent in San Francisco listening to all of that take place was what got me in the door everywhere else, because suddenly I was a hireable candidate because I knew what I was talking about or sounded like I did.
Yeah. So I like to recommend when I'm meeting with college seniors or people that are, you know, coming looking for advice and getting hired, I eventually got to that place as well. Like my first job search out of college was equally disastrous.
Yeah.
I found myself very much in the same spot you're just describing, where I graduated, you know, cum laude. I was better in certain subjects than a bunch of my classmates who were all having a much easier time finding jobs than I was. I was far more accomplished than them in other areas of life. And so now I like to go and recommend people, like, if you think this is the industry or the sector you're targeting, consume as much industry periodicals as you can, because those buzzwords really do matter. It's almost like learning a new dialect, right? If you go to the South, you need to learn how to speak Southern dialects of English. You go to the Midwest, they have different phrases, and those little things matter. They tell people you're either an insider or you're an outsider.
Yeah, and I just, when I got to San Francisco, suddenly finding myself in a job where I was basically working in venture capitalism, which was kind of the industry, but we weren't a venture capital firm at all, but all we were talking about was investing and how to know who to invest in and what startups were doing cool things. Maybe that didn't matter. What are their growth signals though? And so I actually started reading a ton. I look back on that year as like a mini grad school year, because suddenly I was like, I have no idea what I'm talking about. And I just had to read and read and read. And I probably read 50 books that year that were all nonfiction stories of how other startups got started. Like the story of BlackBerry or the story of Zendesk or Peter Thiel talking about 0 to 1 and starting PayPal and other thoughts that he had. Anything like that, I was like greedy to get my hands on. So that also helped. So not only was I suddenly in an environment where I was learning and picking all of this stuff up around me, but also I was reading everything. So that is a big recommendation too, especially if you're trying to switch industries. Just read online, Twitter, books, anything.
Ambition Unboxed by Cultivate Inc. is our leadership development program for driven women willing to put in the work to reach their professional goals. I started Ambition Unboxed because I desperately wish something like this had existed 10 years ago. I already knew that I needed to focus on skill development. I just didn't know where to start. I needed someone to point me in the right direction. Ambition Unboxed helps you prioritize your reading list for quality over quantity. And I've carefully curated each lesson to provide an immersive learning experience so that you can master those career advancing skills faster. We've got two different price levels to meet any budget, but why not consider spending like a man and see if your employer will let you expense it? Learn more at ambitionunboxed.com and use code AMBITIOUSME for 10% off your first order. Ambition Unboxed, the leadership skills you need, the subscription box experience you love.
So.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that.
Yeah.
I think people really underestimate how much free knowledge there is, even on just LinkedIn. All you have to do is sit and look at all the articles on LinkedIn, and that will get you pretty far nowadays.
Oh, yes, definitely. But that was only the beginning, because the process that I was able to iterate on that process. So, like I said, that was a lot of outbound. And because I wanted to work in startups, eventually the job that I had gotten through that job search on AngelList fizzled out. That company actually died 10 months later, and I didn't really know what to do next. I ended up finding a job at a company that was like, eh. I think I was just desperate for a paycheck because I was still in like second year out of school and I didn't really care what I worked on. I just needed the money so I could live. But that job ended up not going very well. I was only there for 5 months. It wasn't a startup, but the man that I reported to was harassing and I had to get out. And if he hadn't been so nasty to me, I wouldn't have discovered the art of inbound job search, like inbound requests.
Oh my gosh, so, you gotta tell us, what's this?
Yes, so I was like, oh, okay, I was at this other startup for 10 months, and then I've been only here for five, what am I going to do? But at that point, I had three different experiences to put on my LinkedIn. And so then I actually had things I could talk about. So like I had said, when I was coming back from San Francisco, I didn't really have a ton of achievements, but I knew what to talk about. And then after having those three experiences combined in a short time, suddenly I had different things to compare. And I could be like, well, at this job, I worked on outbound cold emails, and we call that demand generation marketing. But then at this job, we started working with marketing automation. And so I can say I was a marketing automation specialist. And then that rolled me into the third one, where I was a marketing automation specialist using a different piece of software, which rounded me out a little bit further. So suddenly I actually had bullet points on my LinkedIn. And that taught me the power of keyword stuffing your LinkedIn profile. So what I've done, that job search and every job search since, has been going out and finding job descriptions that I knew I could do and I knew that I was qualified for and had the right years of experience in the like 3 to 5 or 5 to 7 or 10 plus years. There's always a bullet point on a job description that specifies that. I knew the right title that I was looking for, every time I've had a job search, I've done a little bit of update research on like Glassdoor and stuff to see what kind of titles are sort of around me that I should be going for the next thing based off of what I was making and salary. So I like do a little bit of an update on Glassdoor to see like what has changed. But generally, I just scoured the job boards on LinkedIn and definitely never got a call back from any job I ever applied to on LinkedIn cold. Didn't work. Definitely. I mean, I use that as research. And all of those jobs you pick out, you start to see commonalities. Because I was always looking for marketing automation. And by this time, I knew that that was my niche. So that was really easy to figure out. So I was like, this is my title. These 5 bullet points and these 10 words are things that are important to the role. And as I mentioned at the beginning of this, my role is pretty multifaceted. So it was really easy to know the wide breadth of the different things that would be on these job descriptions that were important. And so basically, I took those bullet points. There were like 5 that were always on these job descriptions, no matter who was posting them. And I put them on my LinkedIn profile. And I've been criticized in the past for having a resume that was too detailed and having too many words on it. But once you go through the process of getting every single thing out of your brain and onto the paper, I just pasted it onto LinkedIn. And then all of a sudden, you just show up in the searches for recruiters. And recruiters don't really know about what you do because they're in recruiting. So they're trying to please their hiring manager by finding the right buzzwords. The hiring manager says, I need someone who knows about KPIs. And so I have a bullet point that says like responsible for reporting key metrics or something, and like in parentheses, KPIs. So keyword stuffing is an old idea from like early age search engine optimization, where people would just put the keywords that they wanted to rank for on their web page. And it didn't necessarily make sense, but the early Google algorithm would just find those keywords and be like, oh, this must be relevant. And it would show up in the search options. LinkedIn is kind of like that still. And so I was basically doing my own job. I'm an inbound marketer. I was basically just selling myself that way by putting all of these buzzwords on my profile. And then you can have a description of yourself. But basically by putting every small detail on my LinkedIn profile, I suddenly was getting like 5 to 10 inbound recruiting messages per day. And then you look through it and they always want to hear back from you and read the job description. You're like, yes, this is good. This one's bad. And then you respond. And if you're quick to respond, they're so happy about it. And they'll get you on the books like that day or the next day. And then you have a phone screen. And if you can, again, talk about what you're doing and sound like you know what you're talking about, you pass the phone screen with the recruiter and then they want to pass you on. So I've generated all of my job leads and all of my offers through this sort of inbound marketing mechanism, where I did a little bit of research based off of what job I wanted, and then just literally put it all on my LinkedIn profile. And then you come up in searches. And if you're trying to switch locations, like I did in San Francisco to Chicago, I changed my location to Chicago so that I would show up in searches for Chicago, even though I was still located in San Francisco. So just sort of manipulating the way that my profile would show up on recruiting searches is what got me in front of every good job I've ever had and employed there.
Yeah.
So
I think this is really key, because a lot of times people talk about keyword stuffing, and one, they get the criticism you just said, which is people tell me my resume is too long. Mm-hmm. I think there's a really key difference here between your resume, the PDF file, and your LinkedIn profile. Because your LinkedIn profile, what I've heard tons of, you know, recruiting professionals and executive recruiters and all that kind of stuff say is, your LinkedIn profile, there's no limit. Put all of it on there, exactly like you're saying, and you're not going to get penalized for it. Even if you have to have a shorter resume, like the LinkedIn profile is your spot to shine bright.
Yeah, I've not heard any rules about LinkedIn and what you can put on there or what you can't. But I will say that if you don't have an open sign, people aren't going to come to your store. And if you don't have, I mean, at grocery stores, you see signs for specials on prices and stuff. And the end barricades of aisles will have specials on what they're trying to move. Like, the more information that someone can see to inform themselves about who you are and what you're doing, the more likely you are to get good leads. And they're going to come to you, especially the recruiters, because they're free to use for you. And they want to find you because it makes them look good. So there's no losing there. It's literally a win-win situation for the job hunter.
Yeah. And they're financially motivated, because if they can find you and you get the position, they get a commission off of that. Right.
So, yeah. And they get a percentage. So most of them will also help you negotiate for a higher salary, because they get a percentage of what you make. So they're totally aligned. They're totally free and they want to find you. So make yourself findable and use the words and all of the signage on your LinkedIn profile to help them narrow down the fact that you are right for the role that they're trying to fill.
Now, I think the other main criticism I hear around keyword stuffing, though, is that if you don't do it with finesse, it gets just really robotic and phony sounding. So what advice do you have for like stuffing the keywords, but still sounding like an authentic real person?
Oh yeah. So the way that I kind of mushed everything together to make it read well was, first, I wrote down everything I could think of my own achievements. And then I looked at the trends and the commonalities across all the job descriptions and sort of infused it into what I already had existing. And that's how it was authentic and me, because they were things I had already done, but you can read bullet points and tweak what you have based off of what they're looking for. And then as a rule of thumb, both on LinkedIn and on my resume, I always have the first word of a bullet point be an adjective. So I'm sorry, a verb. So it will, if someone is just skimming, they're going to read something that sounds very actionable and productive. Maybe I'll pull mine up really fast so I can read off some examples. So for example, in one of my experiences, my first bullet point says increased website views. The next one, grew organic search rankings, then converted 65%, collaborated with leadership, drove rebrand effort. You can make it authentic and personable and also sound productive by doing that. And then whether it's present tense or past tense depends on if your job is listed as present or it's a past job. So my current one would, those would not say increased or grew or converted. They would say increasing, growing, converting, things like that. So I definitely started with who I was and what I had done and then mushed in the trends and commonalities with the buzzwords and keywords so that they were in there. So if I had just used a different word, maybe I would just switch it with a word that they were using and then it would pop up. So.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So what about selling yourself? You're making very bold statements that I think a lot of women, even women that are good at advocating for other people or good at advocating for their company, when it comes to advocating for themselves, tend to get a little bit more squeamish or less comfortable making such bold declarative statements. Or they might say, worked with a team to increase website traffic. Like,
yeah,
even when you are part of a team, it seems like you don't have any hesitations, or maybe you do and you're just pushing your way through them, about being bold and making these, like, you know, aggressive, I can do this and advocating for yourself statements.
Yeah, actually, I did wrestle with that for a little bit, because especially the examples I just read off, I didn't actually personally do those as a one-woman show. I was managing a vendor who was doing that. And even though it was maybe vendor-led, I still had to manage them. I still drove their effort. I still pointed them in the right direction, told them what we needed, kept them moving. I mean, they couldn't have done it without me spearheading it. And I would say it's a combo, like my courage to put that on the internet about saying that I can do these things and that I have done these things. I would say it's a combo of the fact that it's not that I am lying about it. It's just that I did do these things. I led a team that did these things. But then also the other half of it is I was also really blessed with a really good boss who told me that I had done these things and knew that I had led the vendor to increase the web traffic and help with all these things. But like I said, they did it under my direction. And so for that, I can take credit. So, and I did have a bullet point that says, manage vendors, including internal stakeholders and external decision makers. I don't know. I have a really good word or a really good phrase in there that encompasses both internal and external and managing the bottlenecks and everything. But yeah, I mean, I just was blessed with a really supportive, couple mentors, people that knew that I was still maybe young and growing, but knew enough about me to know that I thrived off of verbal feedback, and telling me I had done a great job was a confidence booster and thus made me more productive for them. So
it sounds like you had worked for people that gave credit where credit was due.
Yes. Which is not the case for everyone. I also, being detail oriented, painstakingly, I mean, I go through this all the time with a fine tooth comb, and both my parents are in tech and my sister, and my family is just, I mean, like, we're kind of all like this. And so I made them read it a million times. I run it by people who help me make sure that my long-windedness makes sense and that it's readable. And even though there are a ton of words, it all flows together. And for someone who's taking the time to read it word for word would know exactly who I was when they were done. So having the good feedback loop was also, like, absolutely necessary. because it keeps you accountable and it helps you know that you're on the right track. And so, you know, especially when you're working for small companies and you're not around other people and you don't know what other highs and lows people in big corporate companies are working on, having people to bounce ideas off of was incredibly important.
Do you find yourself going down an admin black hole from logging time, invoicing clients, and filing your expenses? I've had to log time for invoicing and budget allocation for the better part of my career. Along the way, I found hacks to shorten the amount of time I spend in the accounting tools, like tracking my billable hours in my Outlook calendar, where I'm already spending most of my day, and then logging them all in the accounting system one time at the end of the month. But my favorite hack so far is FreshBooks, hands down. The interface is so easy to use that I can get in and out quickly. Invoices are generated off of timesheets in just a few clicks. They look professional and they're easily shared with clients without ever having to leave the tool. Their app even makes filing expenses easier by letting me upload receipts on the go. Slash your admin time, not your earnings. Start your free trial today at freshbooks.ambitionoutloud.com.
Okay, so let's take it to the next step. You've gotten the inbound leads coming on a regular basis. It sounds like you're getting pretty high volumes. I wonder a little bit if those will decrease as you get more advanced in your career, just because as you get higher up the ladder, there's generally fewer positions available. So I'll be curious to see how that plays out for you.
I think that is definitely true. I'm a little bit jaded from the startup scene at the moment because I mean, once you hop around too much, you're like, okay, I've gathered a lot of experience in a lot of different contexts in a short amount of time, which was incredibly important for the role that I'm in now. But also, like, I plan on staying here for the foreseeable future, years, plural years, not 10 months, not a year and a month, like not until they're acquired or fail, like it's going to be a long time. So I think my next move is to see what happens to me internally. How do I shift and grow here? And that's going to be a new lesson for me too. How do I get myself promoted without going to a different company? Like, how do I get a raise without negotiating on a new offer? You know, I've never gotten an internal raise. I've just gotten a raise by hopping jobs.
I mean, your tenacity and your insight around having a personal brand and being able to sell yourself and advocate for yourself is going to go a long way in those situations.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I am an inbound marketer and I didn't realize that I was just using myself as a lead magnet, you know? I was basically manipulating my online presence and my personal brand so that recruiters came to me. No.
I think that translates into the work environment internally as well, as far as you're going to have to find different ways of making that happen, because obviously not everyone's going to be looking at your LinkedIn profile. Mm-hmm. But as far as getting your name attached to different projects and getting your visibility raised through that kind of stuff, like as people see your name on different initiatives and activities and things, it'll pique their curiosity and more people will want to get to know you.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, it's really, I knew I had cracked the code. I knew how to sell myself into a startup. I knew how to make myself sound knowledgeable so I could get hired, with also disclosing, I'm always learning here. But if you spin it right, you can say, you know, I don't know what I don't know, but the fact that I always want to be learning is to your advantage as my employer. I kind of knew how to manipulate that. I feel like maybe any youngest child who's close to their youngest daughter who's close to their dad knows how to push buttons. I have that experience.
So you keep saying manipulate, but I think that word has sort of negative connotations.
It does.
You're one of the most genuine people I know. I just want to make it really clear to the audience that I think what you really say is you're understanding like the emotional landscape and some of the different fears and triggers at play, and you're able to kind of maneuver the emotions in those conversations just because you're emotionally intelligent in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I would say self-awareness is really important because you have to be able to read social situations. And that's a challenge for people. I mean, that's a challenge for some people. So I have also been blessed with being able to read those situations. and sort of get out of awkward moments on the fly, but not without the prior experience of knowing what I was getting myself into. And the key with interviewing was really just about being able to explain what you've just come from and what you know and what you can bring to the table, and then also what you don't know and where you can help grow. And any hiring manager should want to know both sides of that story. Anyone who's like, you know, this job is great for you, you can do everything on my job description, you're hired. That is not a good fit. You would definitely want a job where you have room to grow and have the right challenge. So a good phrase that worked well for me in my last job search was, you know, I'm looking for something with the right amount and balance between influence and challenge. I want to have a voice, but I also want to have to solve hard problems that help us all grow together. And so that also really helped, being able to talk smooth. But again, not without having done the research and read all the job descriptions and seen what people are looking for. And there are some janky job descriptions. People that have things like, we're looking for a marketing ninja. I'm like, okay, please just be real with me.
Also, tell me what you think a ninja is, because in the marketing context, that could mean a million different things.
Yeah, yeah. So, and also like, could also, I mean, it's a reach, but it could be offensive. So they're just, I mean, any job description that was too like out there like that said ninja, like stay far away. Stick to the job descriptions that are boring, honestly. It doesn't mean the company is boring. Job descriptions and hiring talent is so hard for companies to do. No one has the time, but they know that they need someone to relieve them of their full plate. So do not judge off of that. Just go off of the bullet points that they're looking for, because anyone who's asking for a unicorn who knows how to do everything from creating badass marketing campaigns all the way through to reporting on their success, just X out of those windows immediately. You don't want to work for those people. So.
Okay. So you are really good at smooth talking. I know this from experience because I was part of a team that hired you. And quite honestly, we didn't hire you into the role we had interviewed you for. We made up a brand new role because we loved you so much that we wanted to have you on our team.
Yeah.
And it was exactly that kind of situation where, like, you were so just genuine and full of life and full of spirit and can-do attitude that you were infectious to be around. We wanted you on your team. You fit perfectly with the small startup dynamic for the company we were at. I knew you were like a perfect cultural fit for working with me and just where we were trying to take the company, but you didn't have some of the higher end, more management level experience. So we literally went back and we were like, what are we going to do? We want them both.
Yeah.
And we definitely want this Carly girl.
Yeah.
And we justified hiring you to the senior leadership team just because we knew we couldn't let the opportunity to work with you pass.
Yeah.
So how do you prepare for an interview? How do you get yourself ready to be that, you know, to just show up as your best self when you're talking to people in an interview setting so that you can close the deal and get to the offer?
Yeah. So I actually don't do a ton of interview prep. I know they say like bring printouts of your resume and research who you're going to be meeting on LinkedIn, research the company, bring good questions. No, I mean, I know who I'm interviewing for and I have looked at the website, but if the conversation's not flowing naturally where I have to bring seed questions, it's not a good job. When I go into interviews, I'm primarily judging them on conversation and our chemistry together. Because if I'm accepting that in-person interview, I already know I'm going to be great at the job. And therefore, I already have the experience and the knowledge from my prior roles to be able to speak to it. Yeah, I mean, if you're going on an in-person interview, and you can't just answer questions right away based off of your experience and what you've done, that's not a good job for you. So I don't actually need a ton of prep. I make sure I know what the company sells, how they make money. But I don't necessarily like come up with a bunch of things and like, what am I going to say? Like, I don't do note cards. I usually always ask what the dress code is. And if they say it's casual, I will show up casual. If they say jeans are okay, I will wear jeans. You can always say like, you know, I'm coming from work in the middle of the day and my current employer can't know that I'm going on an interview and we have a casual office. Like that's happened to me before where we could literally wear anything. Like I could have worn a Grateful Dead graphic tee if I wanted. There was literally no dress code. People wore sweatpants and pajamas to work. And so in that scenario, they're like, it's fine. You can wear jeans. That'll be great. So I usually get the dress code piece out of the way, especially because I don't want to show up formal and be really uncomfortable in a blazer if I don't have to. So that's an important detail to me that I think is personal. But otherwise, if you've done your research up front and you know about the role and you know that you would be good at it and you know it's a right fit, there's not a ton of beforehand prep you can do or that you need to do, in my opinion.
So I think some of this might be specific to the fact that you work in tech. Do you think you'd be able to pull up finance interview, you know, sort of following some of that same dress code advice?
Well, what I did with that, because now I am in finance and finance was a new industry to me, I was totally upfront about the fact that I didn't know anything about finance. To that recruiter, I asked about the dress code and I kind of lucked out that the dress code was business casual. So for that, I was able to dress comfortably. That was still formal enough, I think. And then when I got there, we were able to talk enough about the project and all the horizontal things that mattered. And they knew, I mean, and this is fine, right? Because I just said that you have to have a job that has a little bit of a learning curve and a little bit of a challenge. So for me, going into finance, I lucked out on the dress code, which I know directly answers your question. But also, just being able to be like, I know how to do the project that you need to do. Like the first 3 months is totally something I've done 3 or 4 times. Months 4 to 6, we'll have to figure out how it goes with bottlenecks and other processes and working across, like I'm in the Chicago office, but our HQ is in Dallas and being able to work through those timeline kinks. But after that, like what does the business need and where do we go? And for that, it was a really great fit because that was the element of the unknown on both parties. And so I was like, I can bring all of this to the table and do everything you need in the first 6 months. I've done that before. And in that time, because I'm so well-versed in what actually needs to be set up and be done horizontally, I can learn the finance vertical at the same time. And then in 6 months, we'll regroup and see what we need. And I'll have a better understanding from my learning curve there and the challenge. And that sounded good to them because I was honest and humble about what I didn't know, but I also was like, but 80% of this I do know. And so that was a good reach for them. And the unknown was totally okay to admit, and you should admit if they're good with it, that's a good sign.
So you're such a natural salesman that I think I need to dissect this just a little bit because for people where this isn't natural, it is 100% a learnable skill. But you just said something really key, which is that you focus the interview on figuring out what their immediate problems are that need solved from day one. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of like show how you can help them meet those immediate needs. And then you project out the rest of the role into the future. Does that help you too as well to feel anchored in like, I know I can handle day one stuff and I can grow into these other ones without letting your, or maybe you don't have insecurity around the parts that you're going to grow into, but does that help anchor you emotionally for those conversations?
I think it does. And especially for my generation or age group, considered millennials who apparently thrive on instant gratification. And you know, there's a new interview out with Taylor Swift since her new album came out. And the interviewer asked her how far ahead she thinks because she's been accused in the past of being calculated. And she actually has a song about how that's a sexist term because if she was a male, that would just be called strategic. But anyway, she's like, I don't ever think anything 6 months ahead of time. The interviewer was like, what do you want to do in 20 years? What is Taylor Swift in 20 years? She's like, I have no idea. So when you're in a job interview, I definitely thrive on, yeah, this is what I can help you with immediately. And we should work together in what we need in 6 months because we don't know. And again, working in tech, things change really fast. So that might be appropriate for what I'm in. Other industries don't change very fast. We know insurance doesn't change very fast. A lot of things are a lot slower moving. So
Carly's saying that because the tech company we worked at together was in the insurance space. It was an insurtech.
Yes, for sure. But knowing that you can relieve them immediately from their full plate, but knowing that they're as dynamic as you are and figuring out what they need longer term, that's fine. And I don't think that's scary. Some people think that that is really vague, and living with that kind of like the unknown is terrifying. They just want to know what they need to do. This is my job. This is what I do every day. But for me, that's greenfield, because how do you keep growing? How do you keep solving problems or just being adaptable, which I think is such a key skill. If you're going into a job and they know what they need to do for the next 5 years, how boring does that sound?
So. I mean, what company knows what their five-year plan? I mean, companies come up with five-year plans, but I mean, ATMs made teller banking obsolete in a five-year period. So,
yeah. So, I mean, it's like the same as like when you're a new grad and they're like, "Where do you want to be in 5 years?" And you're like, "I don't know. Like, I have no idea." Like, 5 years is a long time.
Which is exactly why it's important to be adaptable, like you said, because you have to be able to answer the question. It shows that you do think ahead and you are strategic, but you have to also be realistic. You can't expect that plan to not change over 5 years. You have to be able to adapt.
Yeah. And I mean, something that Peter Thiel says, which I've learned from all my reading, right? He says that you should put together a business plan, but if it actually goes that way, you're doing something wrong and your company's going to fail long term anyway. Like, you need to be able to change it. Like, you should put it together so you have an idea in your mind of where you're going. But that's kind of just a personal exercise. I don't know if you actually need it. You know, like when I was in college studying for exams, I would take the study guide and the outline and I would handwrite everything on the study guide, the question and then the answer. And I'd get that from the book. And then I didn't really need the study guide after that, because once I had written it down, I kind of knew. But that was my mechanism of studying, was like getting my ducks in a row in my head, understanding what was going to be on the test as a reminder by putting together the study guide. But then like, I didn't really need it. So if you're putting together a business plan, if you're putting together a job role, that's going to change. I mean, you're putting something together that you know you need indefinitely, but you know you need the role, but the shape that it takes is going to change.
I think that right now, Marie Forleo is super popular. Everyone's talking about her new book, Everything's Figureoutable. But in many ways, just from knowing you, I think your mindset sort of epitomizes that phrase. Like, you just approach the world with, I might not know the steps to get there, but we can totally figure this out and make it happen. Would you say that's something you've always had, or is that something you've developed over time?
I think that's something I've always had. I think I actually am going to attribute that to the way that my parents approached parenting. I had this friend that grew up down the street from me who had an absolute opposite experience growing up. And we lived in the same neighborhood, on the same street, went to the same school. Like, we, if it's nature over nurture or like environment or anything like that, all of our variables were the same, with the exception of the mindset that our parents had about money. We went on trips and we did things. And my parents sent, like, we figured out how to get me to go to the college that I wanted to go to in the height of the recession. Like, they were like, okay, we know we're going to do this and we know that long term it's good for you, so we're going to figure out how to make it happen. Whereas comparing that to the family that saved every penny instead of going on trips and never went anywhere and planned out their adult lives so risk averse was just not really the way that I learned how to solve problems. If I have like 60 to 80% of the pieces, I'll figure out how to finish the rest of it. Whereas I think some people are like, I need 100% of the pieces in front of me before I can start figuring out how they fit together. I'm totally going to give the credit on that front to my parents. So.
Yeah. Your parents sound like pretty amazing people. I'm going to have to meet them one of these days.
They're in Chicago.
Which I am no longer, but.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, that's just kind of been like how we've kind of rolled. Figure out how to make it happen. Like, you know that something is a good idea, something is a right direction, and you move forward with it. Not to make this biblical, but like the parting of the Red Sea, Moses knew he had to get the Jews out of Egypt. He didn't know how it was going to happen. He didn't know how long it was going to take. He didn't know how he was going to get across, but he was enabled with the knowledge he needed at the right place at the right time. And that kind of trust in the universe, I think, whether you think it's spiritual or religious or not, just having that kind of blind faith and trust that good is going on around you that isn't directly in your line of focus in that moment doesn't mean that it's not happening and doesn't mean that it's not going to benefit you later. If it's the right job, it will carry itself to an offer letter in the right momentum. So
speaking of offer letters, how have you handled it when you've ended up with multiple offers coming in at the same time? Have you been able to use them to increase the overall pay? Kind of like, how do you work through which offer you're going to accept? Walk us through that a little bit.
Yeah, so I've been in that scenario two or three times. The first time was that time I was relocating from Chicago to San Francisco. And on that front, it was a challenge because one offer was significantly higher paying, but it was an outbound sales role. And of course, the way that I went about that job search that we talked about earlier, they thought I was a great fit for that. And I'm like, you know what? I'm actually just really an introvert. I don't really want to do that. So I ended up taking a different job, a lot less money, but it was a great experience. And it eventually led me into marketing automation, which is now what I do. So that was like, well, I think I chose that one based off of the quality of thought and the people, because that was like 95% of it was understanding who I was working with and the environment that they were fostering, especially because I was so new in my career. And the impact that leaders have on you when you're young is really important. So, and the other one, I just didn't really think I would last because I just didn't want to be in outbound sales. This last time around, they were almost identical offers, except one was a 6-month contract to hire and one was full time. But both of them were like, this is the product we need for 6 months. Then we'll go from there. The pay was the same, except one was a contractor, didn't have insurance benefits, and it was hourly, or they both had really great direct reports, hiring managers that were both females that I thought were really great and that I admired. One was like, oh, I don't know if I can go and sit in that office every day. And the other one was like, oh, this office is great. This company is known in Chicago for being really good to their employees. That's really important to me too. But I ultimately chose the one that was not the contract role. And that was the right choice because it was better for me. But that being said, I really think that those decisions need to be made on people and the quality of thought that they have in your interview and how well you work together and how well you meet on those first impressions. I think that's everything, because if you don't like the people you work with, it's just going to suck your soul. And all it takes is one person to be toxic in your office and then everything is game over.
Yeah, the bad apple. So, you know, in an episode I did a couple of times back on mindset shifts to uplevel your salary, one thing I talk about in there is owning your power in the interview. And I think when you describe sort of your preparation process for getting ready for the interview, and how you behave and the questioning in the interview and what you're just talking about now with evaluating competing offers, it 100% sounds like you're the kind of woman that owns your power in that room and you don't go in sheepishly. You go in evaluating the company as much, if not more so, than they're evaluating you. What do you think about that?
Oh yeah. I think that is a key thing about interviews that people overlook all the time, especially when they're nervous. That is absolutely your arena for judgment too. And you can find so many things in those first conversations. I even judge people on the questions they ask me. I don't like when I get a question like, where do you see yourself in 5 years? I do like a question that's like, was there a time that you had a challenge you didn't know how you were going to solve and what happened and did you solve it? And I'm like, yeah, I've had a bunch of those. And then I can give off an example. Because one question is visionary and like kind of a half-assing question, because as we discussed, you can't really answer that question. So I don't really know if there's a right answer other than like you're trying to prove that you're goal-oriented and ambitious and have thought about what's in 5 years. But if I asked that question to someone I was interviewing and they said, you know, I have no idea, and they felt kind of vulnerable and honest, I would care more about their willingness to be vulnerable than the fact that they didn't answer the question, but they were honest about it. So the questions have to be good, and then you can answer them. And that's why you don't need to prepare, or I don't need to prepare, because if the questions are good, you're going to be able to answer them. You're going to be able to give real experiences based off of, or real stories and narratives based off of your experiences. I'm totally introverted, and I don't really like small talk, and I don't like people. But if I know my shit and I go into that room and they ask me the right questions, that gives me a time to shine, then it's easy and it's fine. And the hour goes by quickly and you're good, you're golden. And usually usually you leaving a good impression.
And you just don't sweat it if it doesn't play out like that?
Yeah, I mean, I've had some really weird ones where I was like, I just never want to see that person again. I had an interview where, going back to CrossFit, a first interview I wore kind of a boxy looking sweater. Didn't really show off the shape of my arms or my upper body strength. The second one I wore a cardigan, which was pretty form fitting to my arms. And in the second interview, the hiring manager shook my hand and goes, "Oh, I thought you were going to throw me around the room." And in those first 10 seconds where he said that, I knew I wasn't taking the job. Like, I just was so turned off by that comment. Like, do not make a comment about my body. Do not make a comment about who, like, what I look like. It was just weird and awkward, and I wanted to be out of there instantly. And then they ended up turning me down because I didn't have what they called domain expertise. This was a finance company. And then I ended up getting hired at this other finance company that actually services that company. I mean, that might have been a bullshit reason why they didn't hire me. They just needed a reason. And they're right. I didn't have finance domain expertise, but I knew exactly what I was doing, and I heard their problems, and I could have fixed them. I could have made their lives so much easier. But I think we just mutually felt the vibe in the room. I probably changed my body language and my attitude after that comment. And even though we had an okay conversation, it wasn't right. But like this was the right job for me, and it worked out, and it didn't matter that I didn't know anything about finance, and it's been fascinating to learn about. So I want to differentiate between challenge and the word struggle. It's been a challenge, but it hasn't been a struggle.
Right. So I know you need to get going, so I'm going to ask you one last question. Because you have painted a somewhat rosy picture so far of like the great mentors you had early on and all of the things you learned and your ability to kind of be curious and soak up all this knowledge. But I happen to know that you've also had your share of, you know, challenges dealing with sexist bosses and other things along the way. I don't want you to go into a ton of it because we don't have a bunch of time, but is there anything you just want to kind of like highlight or comment on just to let women know that it hasn't been all sunshine and roses and like a super easy path for you from day one?
You're right. It absolutely hasn't. I've had two or three people that I've worked for that I never want to see again. And if I see them on the sidewalk in Chicago, they should run. not really. I'm not really confrontational, but I am feisty. So anyway, every one of those experiences was painful and soul sucking, but they, in hindsight, which is, you know, 2020, they say, those bad experiences have been pushing me in the direction of something that was always better. So even though you're going through it and you're like, why is this happening? I like what I'm doing, but my boss is so mean and she's condescending and she doesn't trust me. And I don't know why, because I have done everything right and she and I are on par and I can't figure her out. I wouldn't have left that company if she hadn't pushed me out. And that was the right thing to do because I'm in a much better place now. So all of those things were kind of protection or just leading to greener fields. I once heard someone say to me that trials are proof that the universe cares, or something along those lines, where the point is when you're going through something that seems like it sucks and you don't know why, and then you eventually come out on the other side and it's better, that trial and tribulation period was really just symbolic of the better things to come. So, I mean, there are a lot of inspirational quotes you can put around that, but yeah, everything that has been bad has just led me to something that was better than I could have put together on my own.
And in some cases, karma stepped in and those companies closed.
Yes. Yeah. So yeah, it's been interesting. Those are definitely stories for another time, but for sure. I mean, that's all about sexism and being small and blonde and having a high-pitched voice and being enthusiastic and bubbly. So you need to be scrappy sometimes. And that's where the feistiness comes in. So.
Well, I think you're very determined. You say you're an introvert and I 100% believe you, but I think, you know, maybe in this interview, you're possibly not coming across that way. And it's because you've gotten so good at selling yourself. You've done the cold outreach. And it's really just that you're scrappy and determined, and like, you're not going to let your introvertness hold you back, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, I leave those interviews exhausted. I've left everything out on the table, basically. All of my emotional energy has gone to giving those good impressions and making sure that the person interviewing me knows that I have a brain. So that's hard. But it also took a lot of practice from the girl who couldn't explain that she wanted to work for a tech startup after she graduated college to someone who keyword stuffs her resume with buzzwords. So yeah, I mean, I'm able to speak freely like this today because I've had all of those experiences and I'm just drawing off my knowledge, much like I would have done in an interview. So
perfect. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Is there any last, you know, books that you want to share or anything like that, that you found particularly helpful that you might want to send along, or last words of advice?
I don't really know. I think we've kind of been over a lot of it. Be humble, be honest. Those are really cliche, but have gotten me really far. Over communicate. So
perfect.
That's it. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Carly.
Oh, you're welcome.
I think this is going to be a smash hit. I know a lot of people are desperate for this kind of guidance. So,
oh, good.
Thank you for sharing it.
Oh, you're welcome. I can't wait to hear how things go. And if anyone has any questions, I'm totally available. I can elaborate more on certain things if need be. So just let me know.
All right. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks.
That's our episode for today, and thank you for listening. We want to hear from you. This podcast is all about showing up and helping to serve you so that you can accomplish your goals. And we want to celebrate you. So if you head over to ambitionoutloud.com, you can record your own work wins for us to share on a future podcast episode, or record questions, things you'd like to have us address in future episodes. So that's ambitionoutloud.com, or you can always just email us at info@cultivateinc.com. Ambition Out Loud is produced by Cultivate Inc. LLC, with music today by Steve Rice Music. Stay in touch. You can connect with us on Instagram at ambition_unboxed. New episodes will be available every other week. I do, after all, have clients to serve and a company to run. If you enjoyed today's episode, please head over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast. It does a lot to help us appear in rankings. And don't forget to share it with a friend. Until next time, remember, your ambition is a beautiful thing.
I'm gonna go down swinging. There'll be a tale to tell. Like a boxer in the ring, I'll give my everything until I hear that final bell. Well, I'm gonna go down swinging, whether I'm right or wrong. I know without a doubt, until the lights go out, you're gonna